Good morning, folks. Al Bergeson, your host for another edition of Smart Talk. 790-2040. That's our call-in number, 790-2040. We got a great show for you this morning. Our guest is Dr. David Peets. He's a professor of history here at the University of Arizona. He's going to talk about modern China. We're going to have a great conversation, everything from what's going on in China today, Hong Kong, the trade war, Muslim crackdowns. So please give us a call. We'd love to hear your opinions, and the professor will gladly inform you as best he can. David, it's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation, Alan.
My pleasure. David is also teaching a course this spring. The College of Social and Behavioral Sciences out at the U of A has their community courses. They gave some in the fall. They're also giving them now in the spring. The topics include the 70s, which for those of us of a certain generation is close to the 60s and should be fun to reminisce. Adobe, the computer programming, human rights, which is a concern to everyone, China and revolution, that's the course David's going to talk about. And so to learn more about it, just get on Google, put in Community Classroom, University of Arizona, or Community Classroom, College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, University of Arizona, and all the information you need to sign up, find out when they're being offered, and see if you can make it. Before we get started, this week, we had the vote for impeachment in the House of Representatives, and I want to take a moment to talk a little about that, and then I'm going to turn to David and talking about China. You know, when you listen to the news, what I like to call the two opposite fog machines, CNN and Fox, you get people pretty much politicized as much as the country. That is, it's rarely a kind of neutral news. I suppose you could claim there is no such thing as neutral news. But boy, once you go down that road, it seems really dangerous. And so what I would like to do is to talk about some backdrop things going on and trying to give us a little context for understanding what's happening with the impeachment vote. The first thing is, and I heard someone on CNN of all places talking about this, and that was the following observations. It may very well be that impeachment will no longer be what it was intended to be. That is, it's gotten so political that really it's become a tool of parties and politics and not a neutral way to investigate, indict, bring charges for malfeasance. When you think about it, there have been three impeachment-type proceedings. Johnson, right after the Civil War, and then it goes almost 100 years before you get Nixon, who resigned before the impeachment, Clinton, now Trump. So it seems like it's increasing. And I think what's happened is the following. The founding fathers, in putting together the United States, had the sense of individuals in the House of Representatives and an individual president. They, as I understand it, didn't have a sense of parties or factions. They worried about those, but just individuals. So if I went wrong, then someone could, you know, bring charges against me, but they could make them up. So you have the other representative body, the Senate, do the trial. But what's happened is that this has now been pressed into service for politics. And so I think if it continues to have resistance from the opposite party dismissing the charges each time, it will lose its original intention. And so the individuality of just keeping track one individual in the House from another individual in the presidency just doesn't seem to make much sense, or it does not seem to be working as planned. The second thing is that originally in founding the United States, there was taking into account larger sectional or political kinds of things. And that is to form a United States, smaller states and slaveholding states would only join together to form a United States if they were given extra political representation. So independent of the number of people in your colony to become a state in the United States, you were assigned two senators. And the Electoral College accordingly is based on your representation. Therefore, as everyone knows, you get smaller states having a disproportionate effect on the electoral outcome. Realizing the problem that someone can be elected president who did not win the popular vote. So that the classic idea of one person, one vote is actually open to not working in presidential elections. So I think since the beginning that change is coming two ways. On the one hand, the impeachment proceedings, I think, will change or be seen as so political that they'll just be part of politics. And the second thing is, you're going to get a backlash from the majority in a sense of having the popular vote and losing, if it continues, presidential elections. That is the sense of not being represented that some folks talk about in smaller states from the people on either coast and large cities. You're now going to get another backlash, which is that they're not getting represented since they count for more of the actual Americans than anyone else. Now, the question becomes, why then are we getting so politically divided? And I think there are two big changes going on that lay behind all of this and is something we need to think about. I don't know that we can deal with these, but they are two things that are going on. The first thing is, it is clear that the rise of low-cost, low-wage foreign imports has hurt American manufacturing. And as such, the upper Midwest, the industrial heartland, along with robotization, has a lot of folks displaced. On the other hand, on the two coasts, the blue Democratic America is prospered more in a globalized world. And so changes outside the United States has divided us internally. And that represents such a serious problem that it is now bled into our politics, and the opposition between red and blue states is also an opposition between prospering from globalization versus being left out. The second thing to observe is that it does seem, and we don't seem to acknowledge it often, that our parties have switched who they represent. It really probably is the case that the Democratic Party, once the party of Roosevelt, once the party of the working man, is largely today the party of professionals, educated, the college educated, and living in large cities on both coasts, along with a number of minority populations. And the Republicans, once stereotypically the party of big business, well, some of that, yes, still, is also becoming the party of the white working class. And so we have another confusion where we associate a political party with a particular position when in point of fact it has or does represent other positions. I don't know if those things help clarify anything, but in some sense, given that we get such polarized positions on the news, having a little background data might help you get a better understanding of why we are doing what we're doing in our politics. So let's take a moment now, and let's turn to my guest, David. David, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us a little about your course that you're going to be teaching. And when does it start?
It starts on January 8th.
And ooh, that's coming up.
It is. And it runs for 5 weeks every Wednesday evening from 5 to 7. And the class will be held at Dunbar Pavilion, which is downtown in a very interesting location. And so, we would encourage any folks who are interested in issues of modern China, contemporary China, but particularly how the historical experience of the last, say, 100, 150 years helps really define what we think of today as modern China.
So, you know, when you think about the historical experience, I think the main thing folks came up with is from the Opium Wars, which was when the European powers established themselves at a number of cities to sell opium, ironically grown in India. The Brits come in here for a lot of responsibilities. And then sold to the Chinese, not who then themselves sold it again to their own people. From that 1840s up until the revolution with Mao Zedong in 1949, China was at itself with a revolution within and fighting off foreign powers. Tell us, how does that scar inform issues today, like, say, trade with the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. No, you've pointed to a period of China's history that many Chinese elites would term the century of humiliation, that is to say, from the Opium Wars in the 1840s up to the Communist Revolution in 1949. That was, of course, led by Mao Zedong. And you point to both internal pressures or internal forces that served to really cause a question of identity in China, but also those external forces represented by, right, the European and North American powers. And so when Mao Zedong successfully led the Chinese Communist Party to revolution in 1949, I think in many people's eyes, the forces of the internal and external forces of that generated that century of humiliation were removed. Imperialism was no longer a force after 1949. Internal unity was, in effect, forced upon, right, Chinese society. And so from then to today, I think you get very much the historical memory in China is very vibrant, very much alive about that century of humiliation. And so when we think about Chinese policies and leaderships today protecting China's place in the world, that historical memory is not very far in the background.
No. We got to take a break. Stick with us. And when we get back, we'll talk more about the trade war between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. We're back on Smart Talk with Al Bergeson, your host, and our guest, Professor David Peets of the History Department here at the U of A. Let me remind you again that the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences is offering its community classrooms again out in the public for all of you to take. The topics this spring, the 70s, Adobe, the computer programming, human rights, which is fantastic. We think of Hong Kong, we think of in the United States, China in revolution. So get on Google, punch in communityclassrooms.arizona.edu or just Community Classrooms, College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, or just Community Classrooms, University of Arizona. The information will come up. It's starts as early as January 8th. In fact, the first class is won by our guest, David Peets. And so in listening to David, hopefully you'll get some ideas about why you should take this course. Let's cut to the chase on the trade war. A lot of people say that the United States won. A lot of people say that China won. A lot of people say that no one won. One, two, three. Where do you come down?
I think it's the very last option, at least to the degree that we understand the so-called phase one agreement at the moment. I don't think that there are really any winners in this. I think the advantage probably lies with Xi Jinping and his negotiators, fully aware that the looming presidential election in 2020 does present President Trump with some kinds of barriers of his own, if you will, in terms of how he engages China on this issue.
So follow up for that, so I get it clearly.
Sure.
What is it about an election that keeps President Trump from pushing harder? I would imagine if I'm running and I'm President Trump, I go, listen, folks, I'm your president. You're getting screwed by China. Elect me. I will put you back to work because I will make their products cost more with a tariff, and thereby you will buy more American products and you will be back in work. It seems the election would work for Trump. Tell me how it works against Trump.
Yeah. Well, I think there's been very little evidence that, in fact, the trade war, the tariff war has redounded to the American benefit, in particular the American economy's benefit. There's very little evidence that manufacturing has returned to American shores. So I think that claim is a bit hollow. I think, on the other hand, I think given the situation that the political pressures that the president has been facing, and you know, increasingly facing, particularly with impeachment, that whole issue is that I do believe that he is searching for some political wins here, and I think the China trade is in a sense a kind of a low hanging fruit that he can make some promises, as I think have been reflected in this phase one trade agreement, that are very important to his political constituency, particularly to that constituency that your constituencies that you had mentioned in the upper Midwest, particularly that agricultural constituency, that it does appear as if the phase one trade agreement will reverse those kinds of tariffs that did hurt American farmers over the past couple of years.
It also sounds like those things that worry Americans a lot. High tech, spying, stealing secrets, business plans, et cetera, that those things were not touched. And what China agreed to do was to import more Iowa corn or agricultural products, which again is a plus for Trump, holding on to the those smaller electoral college states I talked about. But it does sound like the major issues weren't touched. Is that fair?
I think that is. I think that that is fair. I mean, I think these broad issues that American negotiators have been aiming for, that is to say, you know, commitment on China's part to purchase more agricultural commodities and other goods, opening markets, structural reform of China's economy to open up investment, foreign investment, and then of course tariff reductions. I mean, I think that the phase one trade agreement really leaves those large kinds of questions unresolved. And I'm not saying, I think in some ways those questions need to be resolved and should be addressed. But I think this phase one really does avoid those large questions.
Is the China strategy kick the can down the road?
I think it is. Again, with understanding, having, you know, China used to, and I say as recently as perhaps 15, 20 years ago, it had a very imperfect understanding of American political processes. I would say now their understanding is very sophisticated. And so I think they very well understand the kind of political pressures that President Trump is under in terms of domestic politics. And I think they're playing those to their benefit in a quite effective way at the moment.
The Americans initiated the trade war. Possibility one, it's just Donald Trump trying to get attention. Possibility two, the Americans have real concerns. Which of those two do you think make more sense?
I think it's probably a little of both. I do think, and I may be in some disagreement with some of my colleagues. I do think that that the moment had arrived for some adjustments in the economic relationship between the United States and China. I think the kind of normative policy of constructive engagement, kind of constructive multilateralism with China, has provided for a stable context for the rise of China, for the impressive kinds of economic gains that they have made. But I do think with the maturation of the Chinese economy, these kind of mercantilist policies, there needs to be some adjustment in them. And I do think that the playing ground needs to be made a bit more even. But I think the attempts that the Trump administration has made to address those have been clumsy.
Now, the Trump administration would probably counter that previous administrations, a little like getting the Europeans to pay more on their NATO bill, has been tried, and that China kicks the can down the road, whatever, and the result has been the trade deficit, which in part is due to the cheaper goods and maybe even better goods, as with the Japanese autos versus American autos. How does one find a path between being pro-China as a rising country and being pro-American as someone who is relatively slipping in terms of the world economy? Yeah. Or is this just the nature of transitions in the world?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and I'm not sure I have the kind of prescriptions.
Wing it.
For that.
Take a shot.
But I do think, I think one of the consequences for the path that the Trump administration has followed with its attempt to try and readjust that economic relationship is that it has hewed this very unilateral path, and I think in some ways, sort of, as I mentioned, kind of clumsy, if not worse than clumsy. And so what I mean here is that it has not effectively, I think, built a coalition. And I think that therein lies the answer to your question. I think with American leadership, there's certainly other countries, right? European countries, Australia in particular, that have, I think, come to a moment of realization that their relationship with China, their economic relationship with China, needs to be readjusted. And I think what the opportunity that the United States administration, the American administration, has failed to take advantage of is that sort of broad sense, that broad global sense among its partners, or its traditional partners, if you will, its traditional post-war partners, to collectively engage China on these issues. And I think by the United States going on a unilateral kind of path towards this, this has alienated some of its allies, some of its natural allies, I think, over this question of how to engage China, which I think could be done more effectively in a multilateral kind of way.
So your course involves Mao Zedong, mm-hmm. The Communist Party in China, winning a war, believing in Marxism, Leninism, and then somewhere along the road towards the ideal communist society comes a decision, well, let's become capitalist. Let's make the skyline in Shanghai make New York City look like some little provincial town. Let's make stuff. Let's sell stuff. Let's have billionaires. Let's have millionaires. What happened to China for such a right turn?
Yeah, it's a great question. It really is a question that I think invites a historical perspective.
That's why we got you here, yeah. David.
Touché. I think in many ways, the kind of social policies, the organization of society and the economy during the Maoist era between 1949 and 1978 really did not have a sound historical kind of foundation. I think the argument about politics, one could find, right, historical precedents for the kind of political structure that Mao borrowed. But I think in terms of economic organization, social organization, I mean, there is a very, very profound tradition in China of entrepreneurialism, of trade, of commerce, of a private economy that is profound. And I think many of the kinds of policies that were introduced in the Deng Xiaoping era, right, harken back to that kind of historical foundation.
So Deng Xiaoping was one of the party chairmen who followed mm-hmm. Mao Zedong,
right.
And he gets most of the credit for moving out into the world. I still think it remains an amazing mystery that the last major communist country decides to take this right turn. Also, when the communists rise to power, the very fact that there's a history of entrepreneurism, which is also a history of the coastal areas mm-hmm. benefiting and the inland mm-hmm. areas lagging behind, would be something that he would want to do. Long term. Is the trade war going to continue? Are the Americans going to call it off? What's going to happen? Guess.
I would guess that, you know, given the political pressure, there will be a settlement of sorts that will presumably meet a lot of the kind of surface issues that dominate our political discourse. But I do think that there is some very long-lasting damage that has been done, both from the American perspective and the Chinese perspective on their global trade roles or their global roles in trade that will take, if they are to be resolved, if they are to be successfully addressed, are going to take years.
Here's a thought that crossed my mind. The trade war might be the last non-military effort of the United States to halt the rise of China, and with the rise, which could be neutrally fine, but if the rise is also militarizing the South China Sea, and thereby, if you want, cutting off imports to South Korea, Japan, that all that's left for the Americans now is a military option. We just got the signal from John to take a break. And on that provocative question, I'm going to let David take a few minutes to think about how to answer it. Stick with us. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson. Be right back. We're back. Smart Talk with Al Bergeson and my guest, Professor David Peets of the History Department here at the University of Arizona. David's offering an exciting course coming up with the community classroom set of classes, The Life and Times of Mao Zedong, China in Revolution. You know, folks, background information about China, given that we're involved in a trade war with China, given that we're worried about China's dominance in this and that area, and finding out some history, finding out how China got to be what it is really essential for you to understand this. So I highly recommend you think about David's course. It's starting January 8th, so please, on the Google, on your computer, just put in Community Classroom, University of Arizona, or Community Classroom, College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, and you will see David's course to do it. Now, before the break, I asked David what he thought about the fact that a trade war might be America's last non-military option to slow the rise of China and the displacement of the United States from the center of the world economy. The reason this question's come up is history, again, which David will love as a history professor. That is, England, Britain, Great Britain, the United Kingdom, was the number one country, and Germany began to rise economically. And many have said that the rise of Germany and the relative decline of Britain formed an unstable situation that resulted in a couple of world wars. And there are loads of books talking about the coming China-America war. And it's based on that precedent. Are we reliving that history? So you're the expert. Let me just put it to you. Are we reliving the history of Britain and China with the United States playing the role of Britain and China playing the role of Germany? And do we face World War III? Not a small question to throw in your lap, but you're the expert.
Early Saturday morning. there's been a lot, right, made in the past 5 or 10 years about the rise and fall of great powers and the kind of inevitability of conflict that occurs in those processes. Gosh, I sure hope not. I do think that there is a kind of a desperation or a quality of desperation with these latest set of policy directives related to China. I guess I would go back to the issue of the United States putting itself in a sort of a broader global context here, in that we have a lot of interests similar to other important polities around the world. And I think we need to be very cognizant of forming networks with these countries to put forth our concerns in a multilateral fashion with China. China typically does not like to operate in a kind of multilateral basis, but I do think in this case there are gains to be made in addressing these kinds of issues, these structural issues in the relationship with China in a collective manner.
Do you think having the Europeans join, if they would, Australia join, if it would, and the immediate environment of China, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, who are trade-wise highly dependent on China, do you really think they would join the United States in some effort, or do you think they will acknowledge the reality in East Asia, which is what America is to North and South America, China will be to East Asia? Duterte, the president of the Philippines, is perhaps, while a character and off the charts on many things, speaks a lot of truth. And when she simply says, hell's bells, I got the Americans 10 million miles away, I got China right next door, and everyone says I'm supposed to be pro-American, I mean, get a grip.
Yeah. No, that particular dynamic certainly played out in the South China Seas issues, right, where China has sort of laid claim to a significant swath of territory in the South China Seas, building on one of the islands there a large military base. The Philippines recognized that, right, despite American pressure and wanting to recruit the Philippines in opposition to that. The Philippines clearly recognized that their interests, right, were very much regional and accommodated China's interests in that sense. Yeah, your question is a great one. China is very much aware of that possibility or the desirability of building a coalition, particularly a regional coalition. So its so-called It's a Belt and Road Initiative, as it's termed it, in an attempt to try and create, right, a collectivity of countries that are engaged in infrastructure development, resource development, to create that kind of political identity through these economic interests. So your question about will there ultimately be kind of a bloc, that may well be. Accommodating China's rise is really the sort of international, and I think if we look 100 years down, I look back 100 years from now, certainly issues of terrorism and the like will help define this moment in history, but it is the accommodation of the rise of China that really, I think, will define this period.
Let's switch to more political topics and from the economics with China. The Muslim crackdown. I read in the Times, the New York Times, some comment that the re-education camps or the whatever they're putting Muslims, either in the western provinces of China, areas that were largely Turkic tribes and Muslims, that China's expansion from its Han core, as they call it, the Han being the main ethnic group, dominant ethnic group in China, towards the coast between the two great rivers, the Yangtze and the Yellow, moving west, is the greatest incarceration of individuals for religion, since the Germans in the Holocaust. What is the worry of China to take such dramatic action?
Yeah, well, it's been estimated at 1.5 million Chinese citizens out in the northwest province of Xinjiang have been incarcerated or are currently incarcerated in these re-education camps. The concern is a kind of a radicalization of those populations, of those Muslim populations that hold the threat of either some kind of splitism, as the Chinese leadership would call it, or other sources of domestic violence. There were a number of cases in the early 2000s, roughly around the time of the Beijing Olympics, that there were bombings in Chinese trains, in railway stations, and these kind of incidences of terrorism. One really has to go back, without going too much into the weeds here, one really has to go back, I think, to 9/11 in the United States and what became shortly after that a global war on terrorism. And the concern from China's part, as well as the American part, were the possibility of connections, sort of these jihadist connections being formed among Muslim communities in China's northwest and other regions, right, of Central Asia. And the United States basically gave the green light to China to go ahead and crack down in these regions in exchange for American sort of acquiescence or a commitment not to bring up human rights issues.
That's interesting. That I didn't know, that early on the United States concerned itself with Islamic terrorism, actually gave the green light to China. Here's the thought. Have you read anything, heard anything, rumor-wise, that the CIA or other such institutions are in fact encouraging, supporting, somehow, Islamic militants in Western China?
I have not heard that. That would be based on what I just mentioned about, a kind of a wink and a nod from American administration since 9/11 for China to go ahead and engage in these kinds of, and that may be overstating, and I think there is a bit of a corner that has been turned, I think partly due to public pressure as the public has become more aware of these issues in Xinjiang. If there was sort of CIA involvement here or encouragement of these communities, I'm not aware of it. And as I mentioned, that would constitute a pretty significant change in American policy in that region.
So agreed. So imagine we're at CIA headquarters and we're having a conversation and I say, remember, there was Russia, Soviet Union then, and on the western end was NATO and American presence. But on the Chinese end, there was nothing. I bet if we make overtures to China, we can open up two fronts on Russia and stress it even more, and communism may fall. So today, China has taken the initiative with its own sort of Monroe Doctrine to turn the South China Sea into the Caribbean and make it all China. So I can imagine someone in the CIA saying, look, why don't we open discreetly a second front? After all, when we wanted to move the Russians out of Afghanistan, didn't we in fact sneak in missiles that would shoot down helicopters and whatnot? And didn't we hasten the retreat of the Soviets out of Afghanistan? If China wants to play footsie militarily, first claiming it's just making these islands to use civilian, and then, oh yeah, and then we're putting in airports, and oh yeah, they can land military planes, and oh yeah, there's radar and there's missile sites. Why don't we turn up the burner on the Western side? Do you think that logic is going on anywhere in the American government?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that conversation has been broached. And if it hasn't, I think you have a new career, Al, as a CIA consultant.
Well, it just strikes me that the surveillance state, let's stay with politics. What is either part of China? What is the fear of China that involves these, as we read about it, advanced techniques of watching, seeing, coding, recording in China, not just the Western provinces, of Chinese citizens?
Yeah, gosh, I was just in China a couple of weeks ago, and at every stoplight that we encountered in a car, there was this kind of incessant flashing of cameras mounted near the traffic lights, and so, you know, it's very present, right? A kind of surveillance kind of technology that has been employed widely in China, as you mentioned, not only in these areas of acute kind of distress or concern, but throughout China. You know, there's a...
What do the experts say?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a concern, and this goes back, you know, we can go back decades, a concern with social stability and a fear of elements in Chinese society that might promote alternative centers of power, if you will. And oftentimes those can be nipped in the bud, so to speak, by identifying kinds of behavior that the state is just simply does not want, or that the state has identified as behavior that is contrary to the interests of the party and the primary interests of the Chinese Communist Party. The overriding interests of the Chinese Communist Party is social stability.
I understand that. I'm trying to think the reason why. The thing that comes to my mind, and tell me what you think, is that the history of China has been one of expansion and contraction. That is, these different dynasties, and it gets large, and then whatever decay means, or they lose their grip, and then it breaks up with warlords in different regions. We've treated all of that as history. But in point of fact, the success of China today has, again, strengthen the wealth of the coastal areas. And that continued policy builds differences. And they may be worried about, oh, there's John again with a time for a break right in the middle of my thing. I'm going to take this break. And then we're going to, I don't know, John's saying you can keep talking now, but we're going to take this break right now. And then we'll come back and talk some more about what's going on in China today. Stick with us. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Al Bergeson, your host, with David Peets, our guest today, professor of history at the University of Arizona, and giving a community classroom course starting January 8th. So get on Google, put in communityclassroom.arizona.edu, or just Community Classroom Social and Behavioral Sciences, or just Community Classroom University of Arizona. The information comes up, where it's held, costs a few bucks to attend, and the topics range on everything from the 1970s 50s. Why it's not the 60s, I don't know, but let's do the 70s. Adobe, the computer program, human rights, which is always of interest, and China and revolution. And that is Professor Pietz's area of expertise about Mao Zedong. We've not been talking so much about the rise of Mao and China as about things going on in China today. And I want to stick with that. I read an interesting thing. I'd like your reaction. Someone said there was this dumping of information about all the internment, putting people in camps in Western China, Muslims, very specific. And so the speculation was, who leaked it and why? And one analyst said the following, that while Xi Jinping has made himself president for life, nonetheless, as in all these authoritarian countries, including Putin's Russia, there are figures behind groups, influences, powers, that if things don't go right, you can be removed. And that there's a growing dissatisfaction with Xi Jinping. One, Hong Kong just wasn't managed. Maybe you couldn't. The policy seems to be either let it burn out or let it get so bad that the world will understand that China had to do something and it'll take them off the two. Second, trade war. Xi Jinping's job is to manage the American president, kick the can down the road, say a few things, give a few things, don't let it come to this. And third, the massive internment of Muslims in the far west that is creating, just as China is rising and doing well economically, all these kinds of problems. Is his reign challenged?
I think to some degree, absolutely. While Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping, has done a rather remarkable job of creating networks of supporters in very important positions from the center all the way down to provincial and city governments, nonetheless, it's these kinds of issues that you bring up and the potential they have for instability, again, that overriding concern for instability, absolutely, I believe, have generated conversations within the central leadership. And within those conversations, I'm sure that there are differences of opinion. And that has been the tradition in the Chinese Communist Party, in the central leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, that there have been, right, there have been acute differences over policy, even in times, as in the present, when it would appear at certain vantage points from the outside that the leader, in this case Xi Jinping, has consolidated power in a very extraordinary sense, which he certainly has, no doubt.
What do you think Xi Jinping thinks of Donald Trump?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've thought about that a lot. And I think to begin with, there was a, I think there was confusion. Perhaps he wasn't alone on that among world leaders. But I think he's come to a certain degree of comfort in his capacity to read the president, his capacity for his ability to read the political situation in which the president operates, and to read the president's kind of or kinds of goals and tactics and strategies. I think there's a certain comfort level that's been reached here. If you were to go as far to ask me whether or not Xi Jinping would like to see Donald Trump reelected, I'm not sure if the answer, you might think that the answer to that is obvious given the kinds of friction that have gone on with the trade and tariff war, but I'm not entirely sure about that. We'll see. I don't think President Xi is thinking that he's not getting anything out of this. I think that they may well have protected their interests at the end of this particular presidential term.
China in space, huge effort, huge expenditures. What do you think the thinking is behind that?
Well, I think it really is an extension of other interests, right? Extended into outer space. I do think that there's a profound interest in, as there is in sort of terrestrial concerns, if you will, of creating a technological cutting edge that can, you know, be leveraged for whatever kind of military or even military advantage in a world, both again terrestrial and beyond, where China continues to feel it operates in an environment that is hostile to it. And I think again the sort of space the investments in space exploration that China has aggressively made really is an extension of trying to seek a kind of secure place for China in that space.
Let's turn to your course.
Mm-hmm.
You got some bullet points. We've talked about a lot of things in China. Folks who are listening might be thinking about taking it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind just running through some high points? Folks, if you want to know about this, we're going to talk about that.
Sure.
Give us a little tease here
for
why they should take your course.
Sure. Well, really, the premise of the course is looking at contemporary China, looking at the China of today, and thinking about that, thinking about China today as the outcome of historical processes, of thinking about today's China as a product of both continuity in China's history, but also profound change in China's history. And so if we think about the leadership, if we think about the presidency of Xi Jinping, if we think about contemporary Chinese policies relative to trade, to domestic policies, and so on and so forth, really those are embedded. They are profoundly influenced by China's 20th century history. And the towering figure of that history, obviously, is Mao Zedong. And so I think both implicitly and explicitly, Xi Jinping very much thinks of himself and thinks of today's China as very much embedded in those historical processes.
So this raises an interesting question. In the West, theories of authoritarianism or kingships or dictators and free trade capitalism seem to have gone in opposite directions. That is, capitalism, it was thought for China, would make it more open, more liberal, more democratic.
Mm-hmm.
But in point of fact, at least in the reign of the years of the present president, Xi Jinping, it's gone the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
He's declared himself emperor for life.
Mm-hmm.
there are these internment camps. There's a huge backlash in Hong Kong. Why doesn't present thinking seem to work in the China case?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about going back not too far, maybe further for some folks than you and I, but if we think about the demonstrations, the Tiananmen demonstrations,
yes.
in 1989, they were cracked down upon, right? The state and party cracked down on that demonstration. And you certainly will remember the kind of discourse in certainly in the United States and other places around the world as well, that the idea was, well, this is sort of the last gasp of the Chinese Communist Party, right? That you can't slow down the march of kind of liberal democratic ideals that accompany the kinds of economic reform. But as you say, lo and behold, right, 30 years later, we have a Chinese Communist Party that I think in virtually all respects is stronger than it was in 1989 in terms of its power over governance. What happened here?
Exactly.
What happened? And I do think that part of the answer, or at least a very important dimension of that answer, lies in the recent historical experience, that century of humiliation that you spoke about right at the beginning of our conversation.
So pin it down specifically.
Mm-hmm.
You're humiliated, pissed, and so today you do what? Give me three things that come right out of being humiliated.
Well, in the most general sense, you protect China's place in the world. And China's rightful place in the world, its historic place in the world, was as a civilization that I think you could argue led in many realms. It led economically, it led militarily, it led artistically or culturally. And so I think, right, that historical memory, which was so much under attack during, right, that century of humiliation, that this is not so much the rise of China in many Chinese eyes, but it is a reassertion of the rightful global role of China in the world.
Is that a delusion? I mean, in the sense that people who often have resentments at the personal level, you know, I was mm-hmm. not given a job. I hate this company because mm-hmm. people often say, get over it. You mm-hmm. got to deal with where you are now and what you are now. Is this an aid to China's rise, or do you think this is a hindrance to be constantly having this chip on its shoulder that from 1840 to 1940, both foreigners were here, and with the Qing dynasty collapsing on its own, we fell apart on our own, and we need to, or am I being too Western here, we need to shoulder some of the goddamn responsibility for what's gone wrong in China and not blame others.
I think it's a double-edged sword. I think part of the answer to your question is that indeed the profound sense of wanting to regain China's position in the world. I mean, that sounds so sort of general and sort of atmospheric, if you will. But I do think history matters in China in ways that it doesn't matter perhaps in other cultures. But I think that the other, so I do think that there was a profound motivation, right? But I also think that the challenge for China, right, is in managing its current and its emerging role in global society, is to temper those notions, is to, as you say, to some degree, get over those notions of humiliation and the desire to overcome them, because those could generate attitudes and policies that are very inimical to that sizable global role that it is assuming.
Make America great again. Mm-hmm. Is that like make China great again?
Yeah, I guess on the face of it, in terms of that kind of rhetoric, there are some similarities there.
You know, it's ironic, the Brexit and Boris Johnson and Trump, and then Trump make America great again, Xi Jinping make China great again. There are a lot of differences, East and West, geographically, but similarity, posing the question that there's something going on in the world that's doing that.
That's right. I mean, we can call it what we want, but certainly a kind of new authoritarianism. We could put things
new
under that umbrella.
Yeah. We are down to the end of this. David, thanks again for being in. David's offering a course on China. It's a great course for the community. Dial in Community Classroom, University of Arizona, and you will find it. All right. Al Bergeson, Smart Talk. We're out. See you next time. Bye-bye.